for downloading Wine for Normal People Radio, the podcast for people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. I'm Elizabeth Schneider, a certified sommelier and certified specialist of wine.
And I'm MC Ice, just a wine-loving normal person.
Instead of just launching into the conversation with the Peterson family of Peterson Winery in Dry Creek Valley, I thought it was important to give you a short intro into the conversation, which is very fascinating and you definitely should listen to, especially if you're interested in hearing a real piece of history of Sonoma County. I recorded this podcast while at the Peterson Tasting Room with the force that is Fred Peterson. He is an icon in the Dry Creek Valley, so knowledgeable and has so much history to share. His son, Jamie, who has taken over winemaking, Fred really grows the grapes and is the vineyard manager, and his daughter, Emily, who takes care of marketing and sales. Fred's story is that he came to Dry Creek Valley in 1983 to find and develop world-class vineyard properties. Fred developed so much in Dry Creek Valley, and he discovered the vineyards on Bradford Mountain, which you'll hear him reference over and over again. This mountain produces very special fruit. Fred will talk about that. In 1987, Fred launched Peterson Winery, and for nearly 20 years, the winery was located in an old red barn, which you'll see on the label of Peterson Wines. And then they moved to a new tasting room in 2005. At Timbercrest Farms, right off Dry Creek Road, if you decide to visit. Peterson Winery now makes an average of 8,000 cases annually. They are part of my Sonoma Underground event, which is an event that I co-developed with Laura Perret Fontana, a digital marketing strategist in the wine industry, to help showcase wineries like Peterson so that you can find them also. You can understand why producers like this who make small lot wines from properties where they really are stewards of the land are so very important in Sonoma, and it's why it's so important to support people like this. So we will talk about so many of their wines and so much of the history. So let's get to the podcast. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. And I know that if you get these wines, you'll enjoy the wines too.
How lucky am I to be sitting here today with three members of the Peterson family from Peterson Winery? Fred, Jamie, Emily, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks.
We got to give a shout out to Jeremy Stimson.
Absolutely.
Our man in Minneapolis.
Our man in the Mini-A. So Jeremy Stimson, there's your shout out because he loves Peterson and he's been trying to hook us up for a long time and the timing hasn't worked out, but now it finally has. And I'm so happy because the wines that you make are so outstanding. And Fred, you have such an amazing history in this valley and in all of Sonoma, really. I'm just interested to hear how you got into this, because I think the website just goes, your story just goes right from you were just born into wine, like a unicorn placed you here, and then the magic happens. Is that correct?
It's a little more circuitous than that, but close enough. I've been in Dry Creek. We moved up in 1983. Emily was born the following year when we finished our house up on Bradford Mountain. I got my start just in the 70s when I was asked to take some time off from University of California, Santa Cruz, because I was not a stellar student and ended up...
Banana slugs.
Yeah, and Emily's, she graduated, I don't know, with honors.
Eventually.
Yeah, she's on the six-year plan, but...
Isn't everybody on the six-year plan there, Emily? I think it's a beautiful place. People don't really want to leave.
Well, yeah, why rush it? But I was fortunate when I was complaining how I didn't know what I wanted to do when I left Santa Cruz. A classmate, Jonathan Fry, said, you can come work in our family's vineyard. We can't pay you much, but there's room and board. And I had mentioned I wanted to do something in agriculture. I didn't want to live in the city. I grew up in San Francisco. Took him up on that offer, took some classes at Mendocino Junior College, and decided, hey, this is fun. And I hadn't wasted all my GI Bill.
During the war?
I spent 4 years in the Navy during Vietnam, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
That's another side story. But I said, boy, I can go back to UC Davis and get my degree, which I ended up eventually doing. I took a little detour. I was supposed to go to New Zealand, Australia when I was in the Navy, but my ship was caught in a typhoon outside of Hong Kong and wrecked.
Of course.
But I...
Was that scary?
It was a little scary, yeah. But I was too young.
What is a typhoon? Was it like...
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And yeah, 150-mile-an-hour winds and 55-foot seas going over the top of the ship. And we were one of 27 ships that were run aground during Typhoon Rose.
Oh, my gosh.
But I got to spend more time in Hong Kong. And so any event, I...
what a positive spin!
I went to... took a liner to New Zealand and ended up working in a winery in the Gisborne area for 3 months. I worked for an Australian winemaker from South Australia who introduced me, gave me intros to... I literally drank my way across South Australia and the Hunter Valley. Came back and worked at Napa Valley at Charles Krug Winery and then went back to Davis where I got my degree in 1978. My focus was viticulture. I took enology, but I joke that if you majored in enology, you had to take a lot more chemistry classes. And I hated chemistry, and I'd rather be outside than stuck in a cold cellar. So graduated in 1978 with honors.
Nerd.
Culture.
Good
job. I was finally motivated after many, many years.
And isn't that why a lot of people take gap years now to school, right?
Yeah, I mean, and especially young men are tend to be a lot more immature than women at that point in their life, so doing something outside of school. I mean, college for most 18-year-old guys is a waste of their parents' money, but that's another story. And then went to work in Monterey County with my degree for Paul Masson, but I realized I couldn't work for a big corporation. I couldn't work for a winery whose wines, other than the dessert wines, I really didn't want to drink, even though we grew really good grape, was because they didn't treat the grapes with the respect that they, and I was fortunate a classmate was going up to Mount Eden Vineyards in the Santa Cruz Mountains because they were looking to hire a winemaker, and I had heard of it, never been there. Went with my friend Joe. He didn't get the winemaker position, but they were also looking for a vineyard manager and assistant winemaker. I applied for that job, got it, and
that's not a shabby gig, man.
No, and it was great. But the ownership individually they were fine, but the winery was founded by Martin Ray in the late 50s, and it was just crazy. And I was working with the Chalon folks. My mentor was Dick Graff. Make a long story slightly shorter. The ownership had changed. I wasn't paid much through Phil Woodward, the president of Chalon. I was introduced to Bill Hambrick, who was just starting to develop vineyards up here. So that's short version how I ended up here in 1983.
It sounds like pretty much your whole life has been after the Navy, you were in wine. I mean, it sounds like you sort of happened upon it in a way.
Yes.
Then it caught you.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just one of those serendipitous things. It was to me, I joke that wine growing isn't art, but it's very artisanal, and it's probably the closest thing I'd ever come to doing something that had something to say.
And you don't have to sit behind a desk all day, and you're outside and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's very immediate gratification.
You said you didn't love the chemistry part, so when you became a winemaker, how did that play out?
I didn't like studying chemistry. I tell people that if you don't understand the science of wine and understand the basic chemistry, you can't consistently make good wine. The difference between us and our neighbor Gallo down the road is they make wine based on analysis. We use the analysis to back up what we smell, taste. So it's a different spin on it. And Jamie he's much more rigorous than I was in terms of the testing things, and he sends it off to the lab to get the quantitative, but the qualitative stuff, you have to know how to do it, but it's the difference between of approach, really.
So Jamie, obviously you grew up in a wine family here. Was this always something you wanted to do? Did you always pursue wine? What?
Sort of, yes and no. Growing up, help out labeling or, you know, sweeping or working events, things like that in high school, but it wasn't really ever pressured or known that it was going to be the next step. So I wasted a year of college and then knew that it wasn't for me and wanted to try traveling. And my dad threw out the idea of going to Australia, New Zealand, because he did have connections there. So I could work in wineries and then also travel. And so it was really there that it kind of actually caught the bug, is, you know, the way of putting it. It was there that I worked with other winemakers and, you know, saw how kind of cool it was. And I was 18 at the time, turned 19 in Australia. And then after 6 months, came back and thought it was worth pursuing. So I started taking JC classes.
If you have somebody to help you also, I bet it's...
Yeah, yeah.
You had a mentor.
It wasn't needed to go to school. So actually I did 1 year of school, worked a little in the winery and was working in a restaurant, and then my dad's assistant in 2002 got hired away by a winery to be the winemaker, and he asked for help a few months before harvest. I joined on not thinking I'd stick around for more than a couple years, but it worked. I learned on the job kind of how everything was done and developed it from there.
And Emily, you do the sales marketing. How long have you been in the business?
I've been here at the winery for 3 years consistently. I've been here and there and everywhere since I graduated high school and left. I've always come back. 3 years really running the sales and marketing, which, you know, such a generic title for someone that wears many different hats.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, really just trying to get the word out, trying to get people to remember Peterson and want to buy it. So that's my job these days.
Let's talk about farming versus winemaking. So we could go back to your experience in New Zealand and Australia, where I think most of those people really make a very delineated line. They're very technological, right? They like the winemaking and the huge wineries also. They have a winemaking team and they have a viticulture team and they're kind of separated. And then you have on the other extreme, Burgundy where and Bordeaux, where the vigneron is the winemaker and the wine grower, really. Where do you guys lie on that spectrum?
My dad came up with the term, you know, wine grower, started using it many, many, many years ago. And so that's really been our focus, is in the vineyard. I'm the winemaker, though. I do get out to the vineyard as often as possible and enjoy that. But it's a team for, you know.
So, Fred, you're the land guy.
Yeah, I spend, you know, with Jamie taking over the winemaking now, how many dozen years or more, and Emily coming on board to take on the sales and marketing, it allows me to spend more time in the vineyard. I like the process in the winery, but Jamie does such a great job and he doesn't need me looking over his shoulder. For us, I mean, you know, the cliche is you can't make great wine without great grapes. And what's the point of growing great grapes unless they're converted to really great wine? So you can't, they're inexorably mixed. You can't separate them.
Some people think you can.
Yeah.
They don't make very good wine.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about Dry Creek? I mean, this is your home. This is where you make wine. So why is it special? For people who have never been to Dry Creek Valley, they have no idea what it is. They just see Sonoma as a big old blob. What's Dry Creek known for? Give us a little education.
Dry Creek is, you know, in the northwestern corner of Sonoma County, a little towards the coast, and it's just north of the town of Healdsburg, which is the kind of hub. It's a fairly small appellation as far as appellations go. It's size-wise, but it's huge in diversity. The valley floor, certain types of soils, lots of gravel, and then there's the eastern bench is very distinct, and then where our vineyard is up on Bradford Mountain is its own little world. So you're getting a lot of variety of soils and terroir in the small area. And for the grapes we grow, I mean, Zinfandel has always been king of Dry Creek Valley in terms of renown and quality, but Cabernet is actually most widely planted for the reds and other.
That's mostly for commercial reasons though, right?
Mostly for commercial reasons.
I mean,
yeah.
If we just took out thinking about what people would buy, yeah, then the things that would work best here are the stuff you guys grow, Rhone varietals, Zinfandel.
Yeah, and on the valley floor, because the soil's so good and deep.
Is it too fertile?
It's
There's patches,
okay. Yes. There are areas where there's more gravel, but the good soils, that's where white should be growing.
You mean the hardy soils?
The
deeper, right, the more fertile soils. But you mostly farm on slopes.
Yes.
Most of your vineyards are on hillsides and are on slopes. So you're dealing with something very different. Dry Creek Valley is a little bit of a bowl.
Yeah, it's like a gravy dish, you know.
Yeah. There's mountains around it. There are slopes.
Yeah.
And how would you characterize the wines from Bradford Mountain, where you really, that's your heart,
yeah,
versus some other places? Can you talk about Bradford Mountain specifically in the terroir of Bradford Mountain? I think that would be really interesting to hear.
Yeah, as Jamie said, I mean, even though the valley itself is not that large, it encompasses, as you go away from the ocean, the fog reaches later and burns off sooner. So as you go to the north end of the valley, and especially like up on Rock Pile, it's a warmer at the southern end where it's a little cooler and foggier. The grapes ripen more slowly. And Bradford Mountain itself is very ancient, originally ocean bottom, alluvial soil that was set down. And then during and I get my geological terms all screwed up, but about 65, 70 million years ago, when the coastal ranges were formed, it was uplifted and then sat there, and it's been so weathered that though it's very porous and permeable, it's very low fertility.
Mm-hmm.
And grapevines, I mean, there's a saying in Italy, something goes to the effect that if you have a piece of ground that won't grow anything else,
grapes will grow there.
That's where you grow your grapes.
Yeah.
Partially because you got to eat first, even if you are Italian. But secondly, they appreciated that's where the better quality wines, especially reds, because you want, one of my professors at Davis characterized the perfect grapevine as soil warms up in the spring, the buds emerge, you get a 4 foot long shoot, sets two nice clusters, the shoots stop growing, it doesn't set a lot of laterals, keeps the leaves on until the grapes are ripe, and that's what you get. I mean, as a manager, all my years of experience growing grapes and planting vineyards, Mother Nature does more of the managing on the hillside as opposed to the richer valley soil.
Well, you got to control the vigor when you've got fertile soils. You have to do a lot of green harvesting and drop grapes and stuff like that, right? I mean, it's a lot more work.
It's a different beast. Yeah. So up there, the vines are more open. We do get less fruit, but the berries that are there tend to have thicker skins, some smaller berries, more color, more flavor, less disease problems, less pest problems. Even though it's more costly to develop vineyard, and you have issues like you got to fence it so deer don't eat it, you keep the wild pigs out.
You know, at least you don't have bears in Virginia. That's what they deal with.
Actually, camera property about a third of a mile past mine, he has one of those game cameras. And bear are traversing.
Oh, my gosh.
But they haven't discovered our vineyard.
So terroir is an interesting thing. You seem to subscribe to it pretty strongly.
We believe in terroir.
Why is it controversial at all in California? Recently, I mean, I keep bringing this up because I thought it was so fascinating, and I hope I haven't said this on the podcast like 100 times, but I had this guy on from a company called Biome Makers. Have you heard of this?
No.
They do testing in the soil, and what they have discovered is that terroir is real because of biomes in the soil. Every site has different biome makeup, and the biomes are most likely what's causing site to be very different and the soils to have an effect on the wines. So when people say, look at this soil in Germany and it's this slaty mess of soil, which is amazing, it's probably not the soil, but the stuff that lives on top of it that's then causing these flavors to emerge. So I'm curious to know what makes you strongly believe in it, and why do you think that many Californians have a problem with it? And sorry, one other question, let me just blow it all up. Why do you think that it's not expressed more in the wines?
Well, here's my take, and it's because the bigger you are as a winery, the harder it is to actually make wines that express terroir, because if the marketing department decides what the winemakers are going to make, generally, those are more impressive, consistent wines. And terroir is not just place, it's also time.
Vintages.
And the other irony, and, you know, I don't want to bash Parker or Spectator or whatever too much, but the bigger is better school of winemaking, those are the wines that are impressive and get the big scores. I would argue that the truest wines of terroir are the smaller wines, nuance and complexity, not obvious and bigness. And yet, there hasn't been much future in making subtle, smaller wines in this country. The rewards have been to those, you know, whether it's high-priced Napa cabs or fill-in-the-blank for the big, blousy, in-your-face wine.
Well, and then there's the question of oak and things that you do in the cellar also.
I'm a terroir believer.
Yeah.
And I do believe that, you know, the two things you can't change when you plant a vineyard is the climate and the soil. You can amend the soil, you can change your trellising and your spacing to adapt to that climate. But those are the givens. And then soil, and we see it up on Bradford especially, the microflora and fauna does impact the quality of the grapes. And yes, you can't taste the soil directly in the wine, but the effects of what's in the soil, how the vines respond. Like, why do we have such high acid and generally low pH on Bradford Mountain? It's the soil. It's, you know, the climate. It's a little warmer in the morning. It cools down a little bit in the late afternoon when the breezes come up. It tends to be nighttime temperature in the summer, pretty much the same, maybe a couple days. So the grapes ripen a little later on the mountain because of the few degrees difference. But the characteristic in the fruit, I'm convinced, is the soil.
But your picking decisions also have something to do with that.
Well, that too is that, unfortunately, in my opinion, obviously, too many winemakers use the balance. Everyone has their idea of balance. It's kind of like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. But our definition of balance is for that vineyard and that vintage, picking grapes at their optimum maturity, that Jamie can make wines with the least
intervention.
So we don't want, we pride ourselves, we don't add acid to our wines.
Right.
Except in rare circumstance, as they came from the grapes.
And I'm sure that you work on the philosophy that the grapes have to be tasty.
Yeah. The first rule in wine is it has to taste good, and so you have to have good tasting grapes.
But don't you feel like some people might miss that point? They are so obsessed with numbers and bricks, and that somewhat to our detriment, we've become so scientific that we forget the tastiness factor.
Yeah, that can happen for sure.
Do you see that happening? Not with you.
No, but talking to grape growing friends and tasting other things. And yeah, it's something.
Do you ever say anything to them?
Sugar being that perfect 25 bricks.
Your wines are all pretty low alcohol, relatively speaking. Right. They're all under 14.
No, they tend to be. And that's because for our area, that's where we find the most balance in most years. But we do make Zins sometimes that are in the 15s, as long as they have enough acidity and fruit and things to all come together. So I'd prefer things to be lower alcohol, but
manipulate.
Right.
De-alkalize, or some vintages tend to be a little higher. 12 and 13 was beautiful vintages.
Yeah.
We got full maturity at lower sugar and consequently lower alcohols. The 14 and 15s are...
Yeah, especially 15s. I mean, that was just drought year.
Yeah.
So they still had really good acidity, but I don't think we had a Zin under 15.
Yeah, 15 and 15. Yeah.
Let's take a step away from the Peterson family and their awesome story. They make great wines. If you haven't had them, you've got to get your hands on them. But let's take a step away to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus. There is so much to be gained by discovering new interests, exploring new hobbies, instead of having new stuff, just having new experiences. And that is what I love about The Great Courses Plus. It's such a great way to discover interesting information about people, places, ideas, just grow your knowledge base in almost any category. There's unlimited access to thousands of topics, great insight from some of the world's leading professors and experts. You can watch it from any TV, laptop, tablet, or smartphone, or you can listen along with the Great Courses Plus app. I recommend checking out the course Guide to Essential Italy. Not only is Italy just an amazing region for wine, it's filled with so much fascinating history that actually ties into the wine and the food, the art, the culture. If you're planning a vacation to Italy, to Rome, Venice, Florence, or you want to take a virtual trip there, armchair travel, grab a glass of wine and watch this course. It's a great opportunity to learn all about Italy. Start exploring The Great Courses Plus today. As one of my listeners, you'll get a free trial to enjoy it all. You need to go to my special URL to do it, thegreatcoursesplus.com/wine. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/wine. And you'll get a free trial with your sign up to thegreatcoursesplus.com/wine. Now let's get back to the Petersons and hear the rest of their awesome story.
Sustainability. I want to talk about what I call sustainable, B-U-L-L. Because that's a term that has been highly abused. It's been used very loosely. Some of the larger wineries say that they're sustainable and then stuff comes out and they're polluting the land and things like that. So you guys are sustainable. You do some organics. What does sustainable mean to you? How do we as wine lovers, how do we sort through this?
It really starts, and we're not certified organic, and I have many friends that are, and for me, if you do what you believe in, and organic, going through the certification and all that, is really meaningless to me. But what I've always agreed with and connected with in organic farming is healthy soil produces healthy crop. We cover crop. When I had to replant most of the vineyard on Bradford, now a little over 12 years ago, put compost. You build the soil. I put microbes to help. And that's the biggest thing in terms of sustainability, the farming part, and making sure that whatever input, I mean, if you have bugs, you got to spray something, you know, unless you want to lose your crop. But preventing diseases, preventing pests, that's where you should put your time and energy and money into, rather than conventional farming has a bad rap. And it's worst, it's where you're going in and spraying to make sure you don't have, you know, you don't take any risks. And to me, sustainable farming is, it's not that you have less inputs, but you put the inputs into improving the health of the soil, to making healthy vines, and less into the, oh, let's go in and, you know.
It's an ecosystem.
Exactly.
And when you are trying to do soil enrichment and making your grapes grow well, and you have a neighbor who is not doing that, how do you do it?
Well, being up on the mountain, the good news is we're surrounded by pretty much all native vegetation. And my neighbor to the south, the Hamburg piece, they're pretty mindful about their practices. If someone were profligate in what they sprayed and how they did it, you'd report them, because you can't do something that, you can't have drift onto your neighbors and such. So,
but how can you prevent it if the wind's blowing?
It doesn't seem to be a big factor here. It's not been, I mean, occasionally it does become an issue, but it's not significant.
So what about dry farming?
Well, it's funny, because back in the day, I used to get into discussions with my French colleagues who would say, oh, you California, your wines, you irrigate, so your wines are shit. And I would say, well, you know, our wines may be shit or they may not be. But I said, you know, where you are in Burgundy or Bordeaux, you get summer rain. The vine doesn't know if the water comes from a little black tube or it comes from the sky. But having said that, I've come to really believe that one of the things that we do in, or have done in California is overwater.
Mm-hmm.
Vines do go through a cycle. And if we're growing the vine to have the most concentrated flavor and color, grapevines is one of a few things I remember from Davis. Grapevines evolved in the Middle East. Water was very fickle. So a successful grapevine in a good year would grow like hell, grow up a tree, set some grapes, get the seeds mature before the birds would eat them and go poop them out and then reproduce the vine. And it's still the case, if you keep watering vines, you confuse it. It thinks it should still keep growing. And if you have sufficient water in the soil, which we do up at Bradford Mountain, we're blessed, even in dry years, we usually have enough water to get the vines through the growing season, and you don't need to load up a big crop, the vine and more importantly, the grapes will mature, set the seeds, develop flavor and color at typically lower sugar than if you keep watering them. The vine, it keeps loading sugar, but it doesn't hit that switch where it goes to full maturation. Because
yeah,
the components that make great wine great, the esters, the aromatics, are developed in the last few weeks of ripening. And that's why I tell people, what we grow here, you can grow them all in Bakersfield. The only advantage is you'd pick the grapes around the 4th of July and they'd have a lot of sugar, but they wouldn't have any color flavor. So
I was going to say, I'm not sure you could do that.
Well,
so,
you could grow them, but I mean, you know, so great wine is a result of soil and climate that allows the grapes to get everything you want and ripen slowly rather than ripen.
I didn't know that if you dry farmed that you would get more manageable sugars. I thought that you would get more concentrated grapes.
One of our growers, Paul Bernier, who does an incredible old vine, well, it's not old vine, but a head trained dry farm Zin, consistently that wine for our Zins is lower alcohol. And the maturation of the fruit happens at lower sugar.
What do you think about the future for California in general in the world of dry farming? Because to me, it seems like this has got to start happening a little bit more, because
The
drought is not going away. Things have changed, whether people like to admit it or not. There has been a change. Have you seen the change? I mean, I'm assuming that you've seen climate change.
Yes, the climate is changing. It's not changing consistently.
Right.
But it definitely is more erratic. Not to defend people that irrigate, but grapes relative to other crops don't use that much water. Having said that, water is scarce. It's not going to get any less scarce. And any practices we can do to use water more wisely and use less and make better wine, it's like a no-brainer. I have our Syrah block that I, in retrospect, used the wrong rootstock, and I do have to water that a couple of times during the growing season. Otherwise, the vines would stress and the leaves would fall off. And so to say that everyone can dry farm, no. But if you have the right site and location and you farm it, you use the right rootstock, then I think you're not only being more a better steward of the resources, but I think you're going to end up making better wine.
I think a lot of people are afraid of it in California.
Yeah, it is a risk. Yeah. And also, you know, the way we, you know, in the old days, I say old days, 20 years ago, it was fertigation where you watered and fertilized at the same time.
Oh my gosh. Talk about vigor.
Well, yeah, it's kind of hydroponic farming. So you have a fairly restricted root zone. Whereas if you dry farm, wean the vines off the irrigation and the root.
They're going deep. Yeah. They're going to the water table.
They will. Yeah.
They're pretty good about survival.
Yeah. It's hard to kill a grapevine.
Zero manipulation. Your winemaking philosophy.
Yeah. It's a philosophy. It's not a
religious practice.
Have you thought about building a shrine to zero manipulation?
We have a jackalope.
Get out.
Mounted head in the tasting room. Come visit.
God, you guys are so violent. Hunting the rare jackalope.
Quite rare. No. So the funny story is that it started actually as just a t-shirt slogan. It was, my dad talking with our label designer guy, Chris Blum, telling him about our philosophy of winemaking and what we did and how we, didn't intervene. We didn't want to over oak. We didn't, want our heavy handedness to show through. He came up with the term zero manipulation just as sort of a branding thing. A couple years later, it became a wine label. It's kind of developed over the years, but really what it boils down to is we're not taking a preconceived notion of what we think the wine should be and then doing everything in our power to get it there. It's being okay with each vintage being a little different and then finding people that like it. It's not making Coca-Cola every year. It's making something a little bit different and beautiful in its own way each year.
If you were going to call a wine manipulated, what would be a manipulated wine? What's the opposite of your wine?
Can you name names?
Yeah. No, you can't name names. Actually, if you want to name names, go ahead. But you could name the regions. There's certainly some places.
Well, my experience working in New Zealand and the very first job I had was dumping in bags of sugar to the grape juice to ferment because...
Oh, how discouraging.
it was CNH, so it felt like home. It's California sugar. There's a million little additives that wineries can use that most small wineries don't, but and it's
mega purple
is a thing. That's I've tasted a couple wines that I've seen have that added to them, and it's you're going for the sweet flavors and the oaky flavors and the things that stand out and that somebody likes, either a winemaker or the marketing department. And you could have 10 wines from the same winery that have different names on the labels, different varieties, and they all kind of taste the same, and it's that sameness is a manipulated wine, I guess.
Can we talk about your labels? How did you come up with the idea for the labels? So the labels, they've got birds.
Oh, deer, boar, mountain lion.
All right, where did this come from?
Well, our original label, and I don't think we have one floating around, was very understated, Elizabeth.
Okay.
It had a little barn logo, like you see here, but it's slightly different. Same font for Peterson. Had the varietal, the vineyard, and then they all had the same grape leaf motif background. And the problem was...
Couldn't tell the difference.
They all looked the same, especially in retail. And one year, I screwed up, the bottler screwed up, is before we got our own bottling line. And for one of our sins, put the wrong label on.
Did you over-label?
We, by hand, put the new label in 20 years ago, I went to Chris Blum, who's a very talented graphics guy and designer here in Healdsburg. And I said, Chris, here's my dilemma. I like our label. I gave a designer a lot of money for it. But all the red wines look the same. Is there something you can do to give each wine its own identity or personality? He came up originally with the different animals. Then we went with different colors. And I said, look, as long as you don't do food and wine pairing, and they're too cutesy. So Chris, he finds really cool old Woodblock prints that are in the public domain, rips them off. and it's animals that, like a red-shouldered hawk, wines.
Can we talk about the wines? And you make so many different varietals, but there's a thread running through. The elegance is there in all of the wines that I've tasted. I was really interested in the Merlot in particular, since I brought this up to you before we start recording. Merlot is not the greatest well-made grape, but yours is so beautiful and elegant. Do you think that that has to do with the growing? Does it have to do with the winemaking? Merlot is, it's not an easy grape to grow. It's picky.
Well, it's just, it is, yeah, and it, but it comes back to sight. I mean, I don't want to be too simplistic.
No, but, it's important.
But it's more temperamental even than Cabernet, which does require, you know, in Merlot, is sort of planted in the wrong site, so it produces these giant crops of very mediocre, kind of thin wines. But the mountain produces really good red wines, and Merlot, some of the greatest, most expensive wines in the world are Merlot-based. Unfortunately, some of the suckiest wines are also Merlot-based. So it comes back. I don't do anything particularly heroic in the growing of it, but it's a site that produces, it has that rich, nice, plummy mid-palate.
It's silky, but it's got power still.
Yeah, and that's...
That's, again, a California Merlot. Often you either taste power or silkiness, but that contrast between both of them, I think, is a tribute to both of you, the winemaking and the growing, because sometimes they make Merlot in the, especially in Napa, they'll make Merlot in the style of Cab. And I think that's a disservice to the grape because that's not what it is. Yeah. And then there's people that go the other way and it's just, it's too soft.
We have not even a half acre. And I planted it mostly to blend with our Cab Franc. 2012, Jamie was so taken by the Merlot that he talked me into letting him bottle a couple of barrels. Yeah. That is 100% Merlot. I mean, as much as I like Bordeaux blends and our Cab Franc for blends, we wanted to showcase exceptional Merlot wine.
And then the Rhone varietals. I am seeing this valley, some of the better, more interesting producers move toward Rhone. I saw this beginning trend, and now I see that all of the most exciting producers really are doing Rhone stuff, doing some Italian stuff. We saw Bill yesterday at Acorn. He's planting Portuguese grapes. This is something that I feel like I read about in an academic paper, that as Napa and Sonoma heat up a bit, we are going to have to think about reevaluating what grapes work best on what sites. And I feel like people are going to start to turn to people who are growing Grenache and Syrah and Mourvèdre and Zin and Petit Syrah and things like that. Because Pinot Noir's future, well, I mean, one could argue that many sites in Russian River are not suited to Pinot, but they grow it because they need it for the money. Chardonnay as well. But the site is changing. Things are changing. And I think consumers are also a little bit more open. How long have you been growing these Rhone varietals, and why did you do it?
Well, I planted my first Rhone varietals on the ranch, what we called the Norton Ranch, which is now owned by Ridge on Lytton Spring, in the late 80s. And I've always been fascinated with both blends and specifically Rhone blends. And then planted on Bradford Mountain a little bit of Grenache. And obviously we have the Syrah, which I planted that block above my house. What, 18, 19 years ago?
Yeah, 99.
I feel like that wine could age for 20 years.
It's got great longevity.
I felt like I drank it too early.
Yeah, that's the downside of making wines that we do, especially from the mountain, is I don't want to move them along, and Jamie's aesthetic is the same as mine. We make wines that reflect the site, and they tend to be really good acidity. They reward patience, and most Americans don't want to give a wine patience.
Well, so I just tried the 2005 Syrah, and it's delicious, so I think my hunch might have been right, but that's not necessarily true. I just think it has to be maybe more explicit that some wines are for drinking now and some wines are for holding. And I think that the real challenge is that people don't always, they get scared about buying things. Maybe they wouldn't believe that a wine could last that long, but it's true. Patience can be rewarded.
You know, also people don't get the opportunity to try aged wines a lot, or, you know, I mean, a lot of wineries now move the wines out really young and they're going through, and that's the flavors that people know more, and the opportunity to try aged wine is kind of hard to come by. So we try and tuck away a few cases of things
probably about 10 years ago, Jamie, he always heard me say to people, oh, our wines are really good, but they get so much better with age. And he confronted me with the fact that we hadn't really
libraried your wines.
Just talking, but you got nothing to back it up. So we made it a point, from especially Bradford Mountain wines, to lay down. So we have verticals of Syrah and the Bradford Mountain Cabernet. We're stockpiling vintages so that we can, both to our wine club, and now we're talking about putting together mixed cases for restaurants.
And you do make Zin, which you're in Dry Creek, so you have to make Zin.
And if you don't make a Zin, you're stupid. And if it's not good, you should immediately leave the wine business.
It's hard to mess it up. Do you enjoy making Zin, or is it wine that you make because you're in Dry Creek and you should make it? Or
I love making it. You know, it's the most flavorful grape at pretty much every stage. It's, you know, as grapes, as it's fermenting, it can be temperamental some years, you know. And it goes back to, I was thinking about the whole dry farming thing and the whole not focusing on terroir. You have to not have absolute control. You can't be a control freak with Zin. You can, and then you can make the super ripe style and
cough syrup.
Cough syrup Zin. So for us, you know, I'm okay with a little variation. And if you are getting so much variation, maybe it's not the right site for it. But it has its challenges, but it's also really, really rewarding.
I like to joke, when I moved up here in 83, I'd never grown Zin nor made the wine, but I had consumed large quantities. And I knew what I liked, and discovered it was the field blends. And the other thing that was a real revelation was, I thought any wine that was that easy to drink had to be pretty easy to grow and make. And
oh, no.
Don Reeson, the former Ridge National sales guy, called Zinfandel California's Burgundy. And he didn't mean it was necessarily like Pinot Noir, but it's temperament. It really reflects terroir, and it's a very temperamental grape. And we do 6 Zins from across different parts of Dry Creek, and they're so different expressions. I mean, talk about terroir.
Yeah, I mean, well, Rock Pile Zin doesn't taste like anything else in Dry Creek. That's the most that I can sort of, just from a simplistic point of
view. Yeah, and our Bradford Mountain, though it's made the same as our other Zins, expresses, it's more blackberry than raspberry and has almost a Cabernet-like structure.
The finish on that wine, you sent that to me, Emily, the Bradford Mountain Zin, I believe.
Bernier, but...
Oh, it was Bernier. Okay, yeah. Oh, sorry. So that wine had a long black plum note to it, but still a lightness about it. But the finish was just stunning.
That's our prettiest. It's our most Burgundian Zin, too.
Very beautiful.
A little bit of French funk. It's got 16% Petit Syrah, so it has a little bit of earthiness under that wonderful. But that's that site.
Right.
And the mountain produces a totally different expression of Zin.
Did the fires affect you guys? Fred is a firefighter. So do you want to talk about the fires at all?
Well, in terms of grape growing, I mean, I almost felt guilty because we didn't even get any smoke here. The first two nights of the fire, Jamie and Jessica's wife and their daughter stayed at our place because it was toxic. So no direct effect. Secondarily, family, friends lost their homes, spent many days over. We had a large fire east of Geyserville, spent dealing with that. Fortunately, we only lost one house and no injuries or deaths, but most of the grapes throughout the county were picked. As I mentioned to you earlier, the third day of the fires, I had to go up on the mountain and pick our little bit of Mauved, Carignan, and tiny bit of Malbec.
But there was no smoke, right? You were okay.
No, we had
okay,
no,
that's good.
No
yeah.
smoke. We didn't. We weren't in an evacuation zone, so we didn't lose power.
Yeah.
And,
it seems like Dry Creek and a lot of Russian River were completely spared.
Yeah, it's east of
a little bit of Alexander Valley got scorched, right?
Tiny bit.
Yeah,
we were in the evacuation, so no, anything west of 101, except for the unfortunate part of Santa Rosa that burned, was spared.
So, did you battle the fires? Were you out there
the first 2 days? Yeah, I was up on the
with the hose.
No, I was actually helping to evacuate people that first morning, and couple of calls for sort of getting people out under duress. But then we were so short-staffed and we had all our engines out that I was responding to other calls because it's always at the station.
So I think the community probably thanks you for that. My last question, you guys are participating in Sonoma Underground. Fred, you've been in this valley a long time. Can we talk about this change in the business structure of Dry Creek and Sonoma in general, the commercialization? being a smaller winery and how that has changed?
Yeah, it's certainly gotten more competitive. I was remembering when I moved up here, I doubt if there were over 8 wineries in the valley. Our first vintage at the Little Red Barn on Lytton Springs was 1987. I think we were the 15th or 16th bonded winery. 30 years later, there's over 70. So the competitiveness, and we all have tasting rooms, and the valley is changing in terms of its dry creek became a cool place for people with money to buy properties and develop vineyards and have their labels. So, but it's still, the core of the valley is still family-owned wineries. You know, the Pedroncellis are still going strong after 90 years. You know most of the small family wineries here in Dry Creek. So that part, it's nice. There's a consistency. There is a community, but the only constant is change, and the valley is changing. And
does it worry you that who's buying it or the so Napa is experiencing a major land grab. So Stagecoach got sold, and a lot of the more prestigious vineyards are going up for sale. I guess the worry is, where do people buy fruit from anymore? If I'm not saying that smaller guys were buying Stagecoach fruit because it was already too expensive, but you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're a small winemaker, how do you make it work? With how will the economics work going forward with the land grab?
Yeah, people are kind of branching out more. We've been buying some grapes from Mendocino for 18 years or so. And, you know, you see other small wineries and friends in the business going out to Foothills more and other areas, because there is limited land in Dry Creek Valley and Sonoma County and Napa, but you can still find interesting things out there.
Yeah, and I would say I've always compared, I called Napa the Bordeaux of California, and Sonoma is more Burgundy. And I mean that in many aspects, but one of which is there's so many small vineyards and small properties. And if you make a partnership, and that's like, you know, whether it's the Bernays for the Zin on Canyon or the Old Vine, the West Vineyard, it's a tiny little piece, you know, in the same ownership for going on 60 years. I think that it will continue. Yes, the big get bigger, but in Sonoma, and specifically Dry Creek, the parcels are relatively, except for the valley floor, which isn't where the really best wines come
from. Right.
Most of the parcels are pretty small.
Yeah.
And big wineries are certainly, if it's a really good grape, they might buy it, and they might even end up trying to buy the property. But we're not at the Napa level of acquisitions for vineyards, nor are we at those kind of prices either.
So let's talk about Sonoma Underground. Thank you for participating. So anybody that is listening, if you don't know what Sonoma Underground is, it's an event that I co-founded with my dear friend Laura Perret Fontana, and we wanted to shine a spotlight on smaller wineries who often don't get the attention that they deserve. And it seems like there's been lots of awesome interest, and our criteria were that people had to be nice, they had to make fewer than 10,000 cases, and they had to be family run and operated, because people are very interested in supporting folks like you guys with such a long history and an interesting legacy, and you're continuing it over the generations. Are you excited about the event? What do you want to get out of it?
Yeah, when I found out about the opportunity, I mean, I jumped on it. It's being able to connect with the consumer that wants to discover what we're doing and learn more. I mean, we have that to offer our consumers, is a huge wealth of not just knowledge and experience, but sort of the realness of it. And if people want to discover that, we have that. And it's not always easy to get connected with people out there. You know, we travel and we do our little email blasts and that kind of stuff, but it's hard to filter through the big marketing companies that are just, you know, have all the power behind it.
So. And that's what's so frustrating, is that whoever the distributors don't like the small guys, and, you know, because it's a lot of work and there's not a lot of wine. But I think that people, just regular people who love wine, are going to be so interested in connecting with you guys and hearing your story.
For us, we're doing less of the big events. The nature of the event weekend has become more recreational, less about people seeking out wines that they want to buy, and having a venue that you can get one-on-one, that you can explain to people who are interested and curious about the process, where the wines come from. That's invaluable. You can, you know, that's what we see, is that opportunity.
I know that everybody listening to the podcast and the people that are going that I know from the podcast and from taking people who take classes with me and stuff like that who have signed up, they will love you. They'll love your story. And I think they'll love to see you at Sonoma Underground. So thank you guys so much for being on the podcast. You're awesome. You make great wines. PetersonWinery.com, if you guys want to check it out. And they're in Dry Creek Valley in Sonoma. And with that, this has been another episode of Wine for Normal People. Thank you so much for listening. And we will catch you next time. We'll be right back.